As you can tell from the title, today's lecture is called Spiritual Mysticism, and I want to explain why. Thursday, on Lord Ramachandra's appearance day, I was invited to be a guest in a conference where people had gotten together and where they normally speak amongst themselves about various alternative kinds of therapies, healing, and so on. And I got to find out more about what people are doing here in Gainesville. So in the beginning, they asked everybody to introduce themselves, and I had to introduce myself too. And when I had to introduce myself, I was forced to come up with a definition, because it's very hard for me to say what I do. It's just such a wide variety of things that to come up with an easy definition of me is never very simple. And when I was requested to say what I did, I had to do it in a very short period of time because I was a guest. I didn't have as much time as the other people did. So I said that I was a teacher of personal development and spiritual mysticism. And actually, that definition felt good because in a short sentence, it actually said what I do. Now, it's not important for me to say, you know, I'm a server administrator and I do all kinds of web things and I do all kinds of this and that technical stuff, because all of these things are tools for the teaching. Now, last week, I started speaking about something that I had to stop. I was starting to speak about the details of exactly how mystic power or mystic capacities are utilized. Now, the problem with that discussion was that I attempted to jump right into the middle of it without putting it within a package. When we talk about personal development and spiritual mysticism, there's three specific terms here which work together. And it's important that these terms be seen linked, because they are not separate. They are of a package, which is very important to consider as a whole. Personal development is never separated from the mystical aspects of spirituality. And if you try to separate personal development and spirituality, you end up with a kind of I don't want to use the word impersonalism, but I would say mechanistic or a rather simplistic, divided understanding of what is spirit. So you have the person who is developing. That person is spiritual. That spirit is filled with mysticism. Now, I have seen that some people are very worried about the word mysticism because it seems to somehow or another bring up ideas or bring up ideals which could indicate something which is not spiritual, which is deviating one from the real purpose of spirituality. But I feel personally that this is just a misunderstanding of the terms. This is a kind of a fear or an anxiety that doesn't have to be there. It is a kind of paranoia that if I do something which is outside of this very narrow, defined area that I feel safe with, I know is safe, so to speak, I will get into difficulty that I cannot deal with. Now, there's really no reason to feel like that. There's no reason for such paranoia, because unless one develops oneself, one evolves, one gains power, gains strength in oneself, and engages in spirituality, there's no question of mysticism. Now, we know what personal development means. We have a lot of experience with it. We kind of know what spiritual means, but it's rather a loose term which can be defined in a variety of ways. Mysticism is a little bit more difficult to deal with, so I want to define mysticism in relation to the other terms. Now, mysticism is of course related to mystic, is related to mystical, but yet it has a very calm, safe tone to it. For example, you could observe or stand on the sidelines or listen to or read about mysticism without necessarily being a mystic. It's kind of a category of knowledge. It's kind of a category of experience. So for those who have fears of engaging in something which will deviate their direction in spirituality, they don't have to, because after all, it's just a category of knowledge, a category of experience that you can choose to be part of or not. But that's, after all, just a lot of words. I mean, when we speak about mysticism, and we are who we are, who listen to these discussions, who participate in what we do, we really like the mystical aspect of the spirituality. It's something that very much attracts us. These mystical aspects of spirituality attract us because they carry with them experiences. They carry with them realizations, revelations, which we have been thirsting for our whole lives. So not only do we feel good about it, not only do we feel safe within it, but we yearn for it. We strive to attain it. It's something that we're hungry for. Now, in the Eastern philosophies, mysticism has been basically defined according to the philosophical or cultural or historical milieu in which it existed. You've got mystic yogis who do fantastic things with their bodies or their minds or their powers. And you've got these yogis within different kinds of traditions. You've got them in India within a Hindu tradition. You've got them in Tibet in Buddhist traditions. You've got them in Japan in Japanese traditions. You've got them in China, in other parts of China, even in the martial arts. All of these traditions, and there are Sufis who have the same thing. All of them have connection to mysticism, which brings about yogic power and capacity. Sometimes people think that because all of this yogic mystical activity is available in different traditions, different cultures, that means it's actually a material thing, because those same people would say, we are the ones who have actually the connection to spirituality. And because these others do it who don't have the connection, it must be somewhat material. I think that's a mistake, and later on we're going to discuss exactly why that's a mistake. Let's go on with our review of mysticism around the world. We've got mystics who also work in terms of non-yogic powers in that limited sense of the term, but who use their mind capacity, mental capacity. You may even call them mentalists. We discussed it last week. Persons who can use their energy to enter into other areas outside of themselves and cause physical interactions to take place without a physical touch. Then there are mystics who can do healing over a distance or healing directly with a person. There are those who can do harm over a distance or directly with a person. So these various persons may act in beneficial or non-beneficial ways, using various kinds of techniques to focus energy. They may be tantric healing techniques, or they may be tantric harming techniques, or voodoo, or whatever kind of activity which uses psychic energy to connect to somebody and cause an effect within them from a distance. Now, there's other forms of mysticism which are less obviously mystical. They are less obviously connected with some special person who might be able to foretell the future or psychically understand something about us or to be able to converse with the dead. Something very ordinary. Somebody who does something more magical, yet in extremely common manner. Think about a mother, for instance. A normal, ordinary mother. Now, I know that I have seen quite a few instances, not only in my life, but in the life of others, who have the capacity to, mothers that is, understand what's going on with their children even from a long distance, even over periods of time, there's a mystical connection between mothers and child. I have seen, for instance, mothers who know exactly when something happens to their children, who have a feeling in their heart, some kind of like a pain, because they have been connected from even before birth, when they shared the same frequency vibrations within the same body. That continues throughout life. We have seen how a mother who's got a little baby doesn't even have to speak with the baby or hear something from the baby. The father hasn't a clue that the baby's crying because it's hungry. The mother knows it's hungry. The father hasn't a clue that the baby needs the diaper changed. The mother knows this is the problem. The mother knows when the baby's too hot, the baby's too cold. The mother is very well aware of all of these things, because the mother has a psychic connection with the baby, kind of a mystical connection. Now, that's a kind of common, ordinary mysticism that we don't really consider as so important. There's even mystical things that happen amongst the animals, who you would not consider to be very mystical. There are certain crabs who stand next to each other, facing each other, and usually male and female, and they just look at each other until one is totally defeated, and then the other comes and just gobbles them up, mystifying them. There are turtles who are floating in the sea, whose eggs are in the shore, who they simply take care of the turtles by meditating on them. That's a mystical process. Our dog and had a friend in Sweden, a little cat called Cassiopeia, a little cute cat. And the two of them had this psychic competition going on where they enjoyed it very much. They were the best of friends, but they used to have this thing where they just stood, you know, maybe about 2 meters apart from each other, and they just looked at each other in the eye, just like the most concentrated energy between the two of them, just looking in the eyes. And at one point, one of them would run and the other would chase, and then they would stop and look at each other for a long time, and then the other would, or whatever, would run. It would be a whole thing that would go on such an amazing platform. So basically what we're saying here is that that which is mystical is that which is beyond the visible reality of physical things. Or that energy which is just outside of my immediate kind of sensual perception. Now, that's a pretty limited definition. And what it does is that it attempts to separate all this physical stuff from the mystical stuff. It makes this kind of artificial separation, which is not real. I would be happier with a definition which went something like this. Reality is very big. When we choose to limit our perception of reality, we don't see the full scope of it. Let's take again my dog. Now, I don't really care today that I have to convince anybody of anything. We're just talking here. If this is for what it's worth department, you want to believe, you believe. You don't want to believe, you don't want to believe. Listen and have fun. That's all I can guarantee. So, did you finish? Are you still there? Okay. So sometimes this little doggy is seeing things. He sees beings, he sees things which are not visible to the rest of us when we're not trying to be aware of it. In the middle of the night, sometimes he jumps up on the bed and comes and licks me in the face very, very subtly, just a little teeny, teeny, or he blows in my ear, just, and then I wake up, what's going on? And then he's just looking, and then I know. He's telling me that somebody's here. I have to deal with it. Now, when it's physical people, he barks like mad and runs all around. But when it's subtle people, he just comes up very quietly and says, something's here, do something. I don't think that's something very special. I think because he doesn't have a complicated mind, he hasn't figured out yet that he's not supposed to see such things. But we are very complicated in our minds. We're very complicated in what we allow ourselves to see, what we allow ourselves to feel. So we kind of like throw all of that perception away. We gradually let it fade away. We make ourselves dull to fit in within the world. There are mystical things all around us all the time. This is not something special. This is just the nature of the reality. Now, physicists talk about string theory or different layers of simultaneous reality that sometimes connect and sometimes don't. They say we're just living in one slice of this reality. I see that as nice because finally we're getting to the point where mysticism and pure materialism understand that everything is basically within the same category, that when you start categorizing this is mystical, that's material, that's spiritual, you're making a huge mistake. Okay, let's not call it a mistake. Let's call it an artificial distinction that doesn't need to be there. You can speak from the Vedic point of view. You can speak from the Tibetan point of view. You can speak from the Sufi point of view. You can speak from Christian mystical point of view. But everybody's talking about the same thing, seeing it from their own perspective. If you just consider right now, we don't necessarily have the capacity to see into realms which are more subtle or less, that are more difficult to comprehend. We don't have that normal capacity. Yet those who are in those realms can easily comprehend that which is a little bit more gross. In other words, right now, there are living entities whose energy allows them to perceive our realm, yet we are not perceiving their realm. So they are practically within the same space energetically, yet in a slightly different frequency, so that we are not interfering with each other in that way. Now think about radio or television. You've got these waves broadcasting all in the same etheric space around Earth, yet they're all on different frequencies, and according to the way you tune, you can get these different frequencies to hear music or watch TV or whatever. It doesn't bother us that all these frequencies are sharing the same space. It doesn't bother us that these waves are going straight through us all the time. We don't really share the same, we don't really need to usurp any particular energy just for ourselves. We don't mind sharing our space like this because it doesn't affect us. But sometimes waves, frequencies do affect us. And at that time, we become painfully aware of them and try to avoid them. So we do know, we are familiar with sharing our etheric space with various frequencies. This is not something different, not something unusual. It's something quite understandable. Now, within the grand etheric scheme of things, or even, let's say, the grand scheme of existence, we don't necessarily always have this interaction between more subtle realms and us. It's only when there's a conscious desire to make it. Now, it's not that anybody who's outside of the physical body has these great capacities to connect with us, but those who do only do so when there's a reason for them to do so. They specifically focus on a particular kind of a perception of us, or a particular kind of communication with us, or just to observe, or to care for, or to protect us in their own ways. There's a reason. It's not just random, or it's just not constant. The reason I'm explaining this is because sometimes people think that, you know, all of those realms or all of those beings that are there are living simultaneously in their place because they have lives of their own, you see. And they're observing us, so they're kind of like floating above us. That's just not correct. They have their lives, they have their existence, just as we do. And when they wish to concentrate on or focus themselves on us or to communicate or interact with us, they connect to our frequency, and then the interaction can take place. So therefore you will find in Vedic literatures or other literatures about beings from other planets who come, they're always on some kind of a vehicle, be it a bird or some kind of carrier of some kind. There's a vehicle which brings them from their location to ours. And it's possible that this carrier embodies the capacity for rapid frequency transfer from one plane to another. That would not be an unusual thing. Sometimes we walk around and we think, ooh, they're watching me all the time. You can get pretty nuts thinking like that. Here I am in the shower. They're watching me. We can just understand that if somebody is watching you, if somebody is connecting to you, they have a reason to do so. And it's not like some kind of random or constant act, which is like a kind of a etheric terrorism. They have a specific reason to contact you. There's a new kind of activity or strange, shall we say, situation that is developing in the world today, is that more and more people are playing with astral travel. Now, that kind of gets me upset in one sense, because these people really have no reason to do so other than kind of an entertainment or to prove to themselves they have such a capacity. I mean, even as we speak right now, in that same place where I had the conference, there's a workshop going on called Astral Travel. Well, I mean, okay, certainly it's a part of mystic development. And when you learn how to do such things, certainly you are evolving in your capacities and so on. And you can become a tourist in the etheric realm, seeing that which you wish to see and so on. But you're still bound by the exact same conceptions, the exact same desires, the exact same values as you had when you are in your body. In other words, when your consciousness is in your body, it's the same as when your consciousness is not in your body. It's the same consciousness with the same quality. Others use their capacities to learn how to do good for others, how to heal over distance, others to cause harm. The point of all of this is that it's just to move away from the physical out into our energy field and to play with the energy in such a way as to understand the limits of what we can do, the limits of where we can go. This is part of our nature, to expand those limits. Let's take, because I've given an overview now, and I think it's been a little bit unfair because I haven't really told you where I'm going with this and how this really relates with spiritual mysticism. So I want to just get right to the point. In many traditions, not only in the Indian tradition, there's this tradition of the spirit departing in somehow or another from the physical, restraints and moving into the higher realms, the transcendental realms, where there's a connection to the divine source, somehow or another, the divine being who is of the supreme category. Even within the practice of, within Tai Chi or other practices like this, in the very, very mystical, advanced procedures, there's riding the chariot, which is also in Christian traditions or other traditions, where you ride the chariot up to the supreme. In the bhakti procedures, the idea is to go to the place where Radha and Krishna are performing pastimes, to interact with them in the spiritual form. That is pure mysticism, because it first requires that you create the spiritual form. And that spiritual form then enters into, moves to, goes to, becomes part of the greater mystical energy that is there within Radha and Krishna. There are those who do the same thing in relation to Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati. They enter into, they create this form which then enters into that realm which they wish to live within, to experience. Now, remember when we spoke about those who do their particular forms of astral travel or whatever, they're taking their same consciousness and bringing it somewhere else. The reason I brought up that point was because sometimes their consciousness is not very advanced, but their particular capacity to leave their body is, that they bring the same kind of ideas and travel around to observe people in various compromised situations or whatever. That's just the nature of their particular consciousness. Let's take bhakti mysticism as an example of how that can be used to its extreme benefit, spiritual evolutionary benefit. Let's say you are just simply absorbing yourself in the why of why you should evolve, why you should transform, why, what is the point of it all, what is the purpose of it all. So you use the various disciplines, the various techniques, the various ideas, the various services which inspire the why of what you're doing and bring you to a tuning of that particular kind of a form, a service form that you wish to embody. So you have that particular form, you have that particular capacity, you have that particular desire which grows within you more and more, a desire to focus, to intensify the specific spiritual experience that you wish to embrace. And then when you are embodying that particular form, once the form crystallizes enough, and crystal is a very good medium for transmission, crystallizes enough, you then have the capacity to synchronize your energy with the energy of that realm and easily connect to it because there is no physical distance between these realms. There is this idea that there is this physical thing which is covering the whole universe, which is a physical place, a physical location within some vaster space, and these layers of covering keep everything within it. And that one has to move from this location through the layers of the universe to the other location in the spiritual realm. And I remember when we were trying to figure out this universe thing and do something about it. So the idea was, well, if the universe is covered, how do we see other universes all around in the sky with telescopes? And maybe these aren't other universes. Maybe they're just other stars, or maybe the coverings are transparent and blah, blah, blah. But rather, if one would see these statements not as physical places, physical realms, but as relating to energetic obstacles or energetic meshes which have to be navigated through to be able to make the connection, it'll be much clearer what is really going on. Now, I must admit that must have sounded very strange when I said really going on, like, you know, as if I know and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I'm talking about how I see it. Let's take, for example, Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami was so absorbed in his spirituality that he was interacting with Radha and Krishna, or with the spiritual activities, while he was standing and even looking and seeing on this realm. I remember there was one occasion when he was laughing, when he was talking with Sanatan Goswami, and nobody could really understand why he was laughing. And the reason for the laughing was because of some joke that was made on that other platform, which, you know, kind of made him laugh, and nobody understood what he was referring to. So instead of just accepting that and saying, oh, isn't that cool, let's analyze that a little bit in terms of our energetic understandings, because he didn't have to go through some layers to get to some place, to get to that place to understand it. He was doing it right here and right now. That would imply, would it not, that the two realities are intermingled, are in a mesh that we don't particularly understand now because of the way we are choosing to vibrate, the way in which our consciousness is vibrating and integrating with what is around us. Now, somebody may say, rightfully so, I'm not saying there's something wrong with this, but somebody may argue, well, he was actually in Vrindavan or in Radhakund or somewhere where these vibrations are tangentially connected with those realms. Yet if you examine what it means tangentially, it means there's a connection, there's a touch. Now, if that realm is actually beyond all those coverings of the universe, so many billions of miles away, beyond Mahavishnu, beyond, 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 then how does it tangentially touch? How does something physically be so far away and have the capacity to tangentially touch? Now, you may say it's transcendental. I say that's just words. Now, there are particular places in this world which have very different frequencies than other places in this world. We all know that. We know, for instance, that there are certain places where the vibrations are quite nice. There are other places where the vibrations are not so nice. There are other places which are more peaceful, other places more agitated, other places more, expanding in our consciousness, other places which are dulling. You will see that there are various ways in which the living beings can appreciate or understand or relate to all of our physical locations according to where we are and how we feel as people. Just even Armenians feel a certain way in Armenia, Russians feel a certain way in Russia, Americans in America. We resonate according to our countries. We get a different understanding of it. Let's take, for example, the Philippines. In the Philippine villages, I have a friend from the Philippines and also have much contact before. In the Philippine villages, they have a certain kind of tradition for a certain healing mysticism that just creates healers in these places over long periods of time. Because these places have been cultivating that very kind of ideal, that very kind of connection to nature, the very kind of connection to helping people over thousands of years. So the place is vibrating according to that way. And so therefore mystical things happen there as a matter of course, which are related to the place. The living beings which are associated with a particular place are cultivating the energy of that place and expanding it more and more. And there may be reasons why beings from other dimensional realms are also interested in the vibrational matrix of that place. Maybe not the earth of it, but the vibrational matrix. And so there, that matrix of a location, and this is a very important point, may be a crossing point of physical realm, etheric realm, the realm of the devas, the realm of divine beings, who all find a reason to accumulate in that particular matrix location. And all of them find it very comfortable there. You may find, just for example, a gross materialist can walk into the place and just be interested in the feeling of the feet on the ground or the food they can eat, whereas a very advanced spiritualist can come in and go, ah, feel the vibration. Because it's a crossing point of all kinds of energies, and it has a physical location, it has an etheric location, it has a divine location, everybody can relate there. So Vrindavan is such a place. So, Vrindavan being such a place, we see that all one has to do is to have a frequency according to the higher, highest energies that use that matrix location, and to just bring one's vibration in the same frequency to enter into that reality. It's not that, all of this is just to show that the spiritual realm is not over there, and you have to go over there to get to it. It's right here, but it's a question of understanding how to access it in this particular matrix of energy within which we are presently situated. So if you consider that a temple with deities, deities where there is a real communication between the deity and the person before the deity, that frequency matrix can be recreated at that spot, which will give an assistance for the connection to take place. Now let's consider again this mysticism. This is the basis. This is the entirety of mystical understanding, that one will simply put one's consciousness within a certain kind of a frequency and enter into a particular kind of area which has a matrix of energy, and then experience that. And when one has placed oneself within that space, that very particular space within which one wishes to act, one then has to act. It's not that once you're in that place, that's it. You have to then add layers of within your consciousness, layers of action, layers of experience, whereby the energy then becomes individualized in sub-features of the matrix. It moves further into the more detailed aspects once one has captured the overall mood of that energy matrix. And each one of those actions or experiences require an entrance into another of the layers of the matrix, or another one of the features of the matrix. In other words, one expands one awareness within that realm. Let me just review that again. You have this realm, this part of the matrix of existence, where you wish to go, where you wish to experience. You vibrate in such a way that you enter within that space, but now you're there. What do? You then start to vibrate in a very particular way on top of that vibration. You add on top of it other forms of intention to go into particular forms of action to expand individual activities. So the whole point of it is to build on the mood of that energy, to build on the characteristic of that energy. This is the way in which you enter within that reality and expand your capacity within that reality. And it's the same exact way in which one does any kind of esoteric, mystical activity right here, right now, in this so-called world. Why do healers say the energy comes from God? Because they just connect themselves to the healing energy of the divine, in German, the Heilstrom, that current of healing energy, of love, of the divine, that flows through one, so one becomes a conduit to offer that healing energy to others. To bring to others an energy from another place by allowing oneself to express it as an interface between that energy and a physical being in front of you. or a psychic would enter within the energy of the person before them, whether they be physically there or someone else, will enter into their energy and will read it, or will understand what is around a person, or the experiences around a person, or will read the records of the person's past. Once you know how to do this in one field, you can do this in all fields. That's the point. But when I say know how to do it in one field, I mean you are aware of what you're doing. It's not that it's just something you inherited from a previous lifetime or some capacity that just kind of expanded within you and you're not sure how. But you are aware of exactly how your energy is moving, entering, transforming, and is coming in harmony with others and entering into another space. When you know that one thing, you have entrance into all things that you wish to have entrance into. But one has to, and I can't say this enough, one has to have a very deep code of ethics, a very deep code where one has values, values of the highest and most significant order. Because if one does not have that, then we have to examine this, what one wishes to do, enters into that realm or that a harmonization of energy of a particular area in the matrix according to what one wants to do, what one wants to be. Now, we don't really have to worry too much about a person who has a very advanced set of ethics, a very advanced set of values, whereby that person wishes to reflect goodness, wishes to emanate goodness, wishes to be a source of goodness and to connect to goodness. We don't worry about such people. They're okay. The real problem, and this is a very serious problem, is when one is not so advanced and has some kind of motivation that is not meant for the benefit of others. Here is where spiritual mysticism can create difficulty, not only for yourself, others, or the world. And because of that, these actual mystical techniques, which are not that complicated, which are not that difficult to understand, are kept hidden. Therefore, the whole concept of initiation into secret societies, initiation into secrets, spiritual secrets, started. It's an attempt to filter out unwanted personalities, to filter out those who will misuse these powerful energies. Because when these energies are misused, in that particular matrix, everything becomes diluted or distorted to a certain extent. Let me give you an example in relation to healing. If I was to do a healing on somebody and another person were to come in whose energy was in a totally different place, their energy would mix with mine and would distort what I'm doing, would make it much more difficult because I would first have to deal with them in order to concentrate on what I was doing. Holy places were traditionally, wherever they may have been in the world, traditionally meant to concentrate people in a place who all had the same idea, some kind of spiritual evolutionary idea. Yet nowadays, these holy places have become touristic places, places where all kinds of other ideas, ideals, values, money-making, economic development, all of the same things are brought there. So the holy place becomes a place of distorted energies, which actually confuse one more. And the more these energies enter into it, the less the connection between those other energies in the matrix that are non-physical, the less they interact with the place, the matrix of the physical place. So the physical place no longer has the same capacity to fuel our mysticism. So what do you do? Well, ultimately, what everybody's doing, creating new places, creating new matrices, and calling down, invoking the connections to these other realms, invoking these connections to reestablish that energy which that particular group wishes to have. That's what we do here every Saturday. We create a matrix. All those who are listening, all those who are viewing, we are together invoking a virtual matrix from around the world where we connect energetically and call to this matrix, specific matrix location, like a stamp within it. We call all these energies to interact with us to expand our capacity to understand and to experience this. Sometimes people get upset. I hear from second, third, fourth hand sources, oh, he talks about all this, you know, material things, these psychological things, these new age things. This is not spiritual. This is not interesting for me. But what I'm really trying to do is to create within all of us at least one aware capability and experience to connect consciously into one space within the matrix, a specific matrix, and to act at least one action within that space. Because as soon as any one of us has that awareness of exactly what it means to enter into a space, or alternatively, even better, to create that space, to call the energies together to create that space. Remember the pyramid meditations or the meditations we create where we create a space? As soon as you can create that one space, and then from within the space, do one thing, you've got it. And when you've got it, you can do whatever you want. And what will you do with it? It depends on your consciousness. You can explore realms. You can explore connections. You can explore relationships. You can explore yourself. You can go to the places you wish to go. You can connect with Radha and Krishna. You can explore that relationship. You can experience it. You can feel their energy. You can then transmit that energy. Because once you feel it, you can transmit it. It's the same thing, that same quality. And you could send it to others for healing purposes. You can try to help people who are in danger. You can help people who are lost after death and don't know where to go, what to do. You can be a worker of the Spirit. You can be a light worker of the Spirit. You could be a living angel, an angel in this world who just simply exists for expanding divine love. Now, somebody may say, criticize you. Somebody may say that's very new agey. Somebody may say that's just simply strange. That's not in any book. I say, just think about what you are and think about why somebody would object to it. Because after all, you're embodying that love of Radha and Krishna. You are reflecting it. You are emanating it. You are using it for good. How can it be in any way wrong? So there's much, much more I can say about this spiritual mysticism. I just barely scratched the surface. I just got to the point at which we can just at least understand what it is we're doing, understand what it is we're trying to get to, or at least what I'm trying to help you do, or trying to help you get to, making it very clear what is the point of it all, why it is this way. And I just hope, I pray, I wish I simply invoke the blessings of Radha and Krishna, of Lord Chaitanya, of Lord Nityananda, the Panchatattva, of all the demigods, the devas, of all the beings who care, all the angels, all of the personalities who wish to help us by enlivening our particular matrix of within this existence, to just let us experience to the greatest degree that which we deserve in our lives. So let us now take a break until the for 30 minutes, and we'll come back at 20 minutes of the hour. 20 minutes of the hour. And please come back in time. Even last week someone said 15 minutes, it became 30 minutes anyway. And send me your questions if you have any, or requests. You can also request that we do something. The first question I have today, which I'll just answer because I think I've understood what the question means, although it hasn't been clear. The idea that if you want to help others, you should only do it when they ask for it. And that's a very that's a very good question. That's part of the ethic. If you really want to help somebody, the ethic requires that they wish to get the help from you. They are requesting you to help them. Because otherwise, you run into the difficulty of a contradictory, a contradiction. It will be blocked. It will be not wanted. And not wanted energy has a very hard time being beneficial. For example, if you try to psychically work with this person who doesn't want you to, they will block you off or send you contradictory things, or you will just be a disturbance to them. It's no fun for either. And especially if you're trying to do some healing kind of an energy, you must have the cooperation of the person you're trying to heal, because they will just block it off, or it will harm them. It will harm them even more than help them. You know, sometimes spiritual traditions have the idea that they just give what they have to someone else, and the other person should just be smart enough to take it because it's good for them, and it doesn't matter whether they want it or not, it's good for them. And therefore they may have no problem with trying to push things upon people, because after all they think it's good for them and they think they're justified. But that is not necessarily something which is beneficial for anybody, because when we don't want something, we make sure we don't get it. I mean, you can of course force things down people's throat, but that is not very beneficial for them. You know, when you do things to people against their will, you're not a friend in reality. You are somebody who's imposing upon others. And imposing upon others is not a good thing. It never is a good thing. Therefore, part of the ethic is to always work cooperatively with others, cooperatively with others' energies, cooperatively with others' desires. Therefore, you would ask, would you like this? May I do that? Would you want this to be done? What is your point? What is your goal? What do you wish? So I think that this ethic is always the foundation upon which any advancement can be made, is that you must have this ethic. Now I have another question about asking about the details of the structure of subtle bodies. Especially, it's interesting to know what is the etheric body, how do you feel it, and what is the emotional body. You know, I've seen a lot of drawings. I've seen a lot of colorful representations of the bodies, of the layers. And these representations always create the impression that there's some layers closer, there's some layers further away. One is not sure if they intermingle throughout that journey from closer to further away, or rather these are just parts of the same thing. And within that description, there is always this implication that there's a kind of a fixed structure within the etheric energy of a person. Well, I have a hard time with that one. I don't particularly think that's true. I don't think it's true because you can't really quantify. You can't really quantify the energies in a simple line drawing around the core of the energy, which seems to be the body. Because one can manipulate the intensity of a particular form of the energy according to one's desire or according to the way in which circumstances have arisen around us. Let's take, for example, a normal state. In other words, a state in which one is not terribly active in any particular way, kind of a neutral state, as compared to some state where one of the energies is activated. There is a very big difference in the way these energies will manifest, the way they will look, the way it will be perceived by others because of the activation of that force. So, just like, for example, when somebody is overwhelmed by lust or somebody is overwhelmed by rage, these are such powerful energies. They pervade through the whole energy field and dominate it. So energetically speaking, that person would look very different in that state, the activated state, than the person would look in the neutral state. Now one may say, well, these distinctions within the body are more according to the subtle, the more and more subtle, or the more and more advanced, or the more and more sophisticated manner in which this manifests, the energies manifest. I feel it's not advantageous to think about these distinctions as geographical or quantitative within the etheric fields around a person. Because it may give a false sense of security that we are understanding a person according to the intensity of how we feel them at a particular time. For example, if you were to take your hand and move it closer and closer to a person's energy, as you move closer and closer, you will feel a greater intensity. You will feel a variety of experiences as you get closer. And while you are coming closer, you are experiencing different things, it may seem to become more intense as you get closer and closer to the person, because it's more obvious the energies the person is emanating. Yet the same person who's concentrating or focusing on a particular motion, which usually might not be felt till one is very close, can blast that energy across the room. So one may say that when my emotion is at rest, it has one kind of a feeling, yet when it is activated, it has another. So in other words, I am holding back my energy and letting my energy go forth. So this is the same for all of the aspects of my etheric energy. I can pull back my spiritual, for example, expansion of energy. I can pull it back. I can pull back my psychic energy. I can turn it off. I can pull back the way in which I emanate any particular energy at any time. However, there's one thing that I can't really hide. For example, the power to pull it back, the power to bring it under control is a power. It's not like, you know, you can put yourself in a little black box and nobody will even know you exist. You're stealth. You're in stealth mode. The power that you've used to do that still is manifesting there. It has gone out, it has encompassed, and it has brought in. Those who can see will feel or see that particular power. They may not know the detail of it, but they know the power. So one doesn't really have capacity to completely go into a stealth mode and be unknown. You will be known. I mean, of course, you could try to, whatever energy you have, use it so that others don't notice, like to sneak around the house. That you can do. But as soon as somebody focuses on you, you're exposed. I mean, you can't hide the energy that you have. So this very question about the structure of subtle bodies is in reality contradictory to the main principle I have been presenting throughout this whatever period of time we have been discussing such things. Because when you ask about a structure like that, you mean to say, there's this part, there's this part, there's this functioning, there's that functioning, things fit together. Structure means it fits together in a particular way to create a form. And that's all right also if you take it structure in the sense that how does it manifest? Because that's also a structure, the structure of the manifestation. So if I were to take your question in that way, it would make perfect sense and would fit compatibly within what I've been saying. Because the manifestation, the specific manifestation of my energies, is according to my consciousness, which is my energy, that source, that me, that is everything about me, that manifests through the cells, through the body, through the form, through the energies, that flow around me out from my source of consciousness to the external world. So it manifests structures according to my consciousness. So sometimes I can look like this, I can feel like that, I can work like this, I can emanate like that, I can do some kind of hiding like this, I can be empathetic like that, I can understand. Did I just lose you? Okay, I don't hear the period at the end. So what we really have is a metamorphosis, a continuous metamorphosis within the structure, quote unquote, of how my consciousness is manifesting. Now, I know that our analytical minds want to differentiate. They want to differentiate between something psychic, between something emotional, between some light, between some receptivity, between some giving. We want to differentiate. I understand the analytical mind very well. I don't understand by my mind. Me personally, my mind is not a vehicle through which understanding comes to me. It may be the area within which I assemble words, or within which I assemble concepts, or within which I analyze that which I have already understood. And there's a big difference. So the mind fills that space as the interface between my energy, my understanding, my energy, and the exterior aspects with which I work. But not in all respects. In some respects, my energy goes directly to an external area, for example, through healing, or for example, even when now I am speaking, my mind has nothing to do with this. There is very little functioning of the mind. There is practically none. It is a direct manifestation from my understanding, which is not connected with my mind. Now, somebody may call that intelligence, but I think that's a really bad word. It's not a bad word. The word is neither good or bad, but if you use the word intelligence, you are implying, it makes us think in terms of some kind of analytical capacity or some kind of like means that can be measured, like in an intelligence test or in what you do and things like that. I don't think that's the right word. I don't think the word buddhi in Sanskrit translates properly into intelligence. I would suggest, that it would be much better to speak of that terminology in terms of knowing. There's a difference. It's a knowing. It's a means by which my consciousness may manifest its knowing in terms of reality, or even that which is not. Yes, reality in all of its terms, all of its sense. This is the chit potency. When you get really right down to it, you've got sat, which is existence. We exist. We've got, that is just the state of being. Existence. We've got chit, which that state of existence is a state of knowing. It's a state of knowing. In all respects, experiences are knowing. And it's a state when not distorted in any way, which is a state of ananda, or that satisfaction, that blissfulness, which is us. These are very good terms. So maybe the real problem we're talking about here is a problem of the question asking about subtle bodies. Because what I'm really saying here is I don't accept the concept of subtle bodies. Rather, it is just chit, knowing, within existence, manifesting according to our consciousness, which is based on desire, which is based on dealing with circumstances and so on. In other words, instead of disintegrating the aspects of our existence for the sake of analysis, I am more inclined to integrate the aspects of our existence for the sake of knowing. To catch the scent of knowing and to understand how the energies are manifesting according to the way my consciousness focuses itself. Now, this question I can go on and on and on, but I guess I've made the point. I mean, maybe I haven't answered the question the way the questioner wanted. Maybe I haven't done a very complete job. And okay, but at least I think I've set out some kind of parameter within which I would answer the question in a more complete way, if I ever would. So I guess you get the point. Here's another question which is actually related to that, and it's also coming from the same place, from the Pujari department. Often esoteric people come to the temple who know nothing about the deities. Well, I would question that statement, but that's what's being said here. They know nothing about the deities, yet they feel them, they see their movements, they talk to them, and then go away and never come again. And yet there are devotees who've been sincerely serving the deities for years and don't have such an experience. Is real devotion possible without mystical experience? Now, well, I can answer that in many ways, but I'll start off by relating what happened to me when I first came to the temple. After I was chanting, for the first time I had been in the temple, I had been there maybe 4 hours, 5 hours, and I was chanting, and Vishnu spoke to me through a picture on the wall. Movement, voice, direct connection, total ecstasy, absolutely happened. There's no way around it. That's what convinced me, not anybody else, not anything anyone said. In fact, after that point, it was almost as if every person I met was trying to convince me that that experience was not what it was. You see, their opinion was that no one can have such experiences unless you have done so much for so long and advanced and gotten mercy and this and that. And because that's the only way to have such an experience, therefore you are imagining things, or you're a sahajya, or whatever insult or put down would come next. Yet I knew my experience. I was totally convinced. I understood it very well. I didn't need these people to comment on it. And after the first time of mentioning it and getting such a response, I never mentioned it again. I actually had, I'm sorry to say this, but for many months, I had the opinion that I was surrounded by very strange people in this temple. And these were very, not very advanced people at all. And I just simply tolerated them. And I got very upset most of the time when anybody would interact with me on this level of, you know, repression, put down. You couldn't possibly understand anything because you are a bhakta. Now, that was my experience. Because I have the internal capacity to actually believe what I experience, I didn't mind neglecting not taking seriously what other people said. But there are many who couldn't do that. There are many who just take one look at what's around them, say, I had my experience, that's fine, now I'm going away, continuing my life. That's perfectly acceptable. And when you don't have the idea in your head that something's not possible, you have nothing to stop you from doing it. If you're living in an atmosphere where the whole mood is that it's not possible, you pick that up, you digest that mood, and you accept it somehow or another. But if you're unaware that it's not possible, you'll just do it. And many times you'll succeed because you didn't even know there was a problem. So that's what I think might be the answer to your question, that don't think that just because somebody is a new agey person that they have no capacity to understand. Whereas somebody who's, you know, directly in connection with the deities, yet doesn't really have faith in themselves, doesn't really have that energetic connection, may not be able to know the same thing. Therefore, I've been trying to bring the mystical aspect back so that the experiences are again brought into the limelight, that the experiential aspect of bhakti is recognized, is accepted, is embraced, because it's where the ananda is.